Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Ted Epperly and I will discuss his book, Fractured, America's Broken Healthcare System and What We Must Do to Heal It. This is an excellent and easy read about our current healthcare system and his recommendations for change. I might quickly add, for those who still might question the need for change, these people must objectively, in my opinion, come to grips with Dr. Epperly's observation and others that our healthcare premiums, for example, our healthcare insurance premiums are currently rising four times faster than wages in our country. There are a number of issues that are just unsustainable regarding healthcare costs in particular. You can reach us today with your questions and comments. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Epperly is a family physician in Boise, Idaho, where he sees patients. He teaches family medicine residents, and he directs the Family Medicine Residency Program of Idaho. He's the past president and past chairman of the board of the American Academy of Family Physicians, and he is currently co-chair of the Center on Accountable Care of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. This is a group of 1,000 organizations dedicated to transforming the United States healthcare system around primary care. Dr. Epperly, it is a pleasure to have you join us. Thanks again for taking the time.
It is my honor to be with you all.
All right. Let's jump right into this issue. Let's go over the list of problems as you see it with our current healthcare system.
Well, the United States healthcare system has struggled for 100 years, really, in trying to get a collective system of healthcare that meets the needs of our patients. The first thing that I would mention of several is that we have the wrong focus. Our focus is on disease and sickness. It's not on health and wellness. And so our system has created a system where we pay a lot of money to do things to people and not to prevent those things from happening in the first place. We pay pennies on the dollar to control hypertension and diabetes and asthma, but we'll pay hundreds of thousands of dollars on the back end to do amputations and renal dialysis and heart attack and stroke care. The second issue that I would say, Thad, is that we have a very poor system of coverage for everybody. Right now in the United States, we have 50 million people, 50 million that don't have any sort of health insurance. And that's the size of an average-sized European nation. It's the collective size of 17 of our states. And all of these people don't have any health care at all. And so what happens is those folks lack timely access to the system. And so when they do come in and they live sicker and die younger, they have a lot of health costs. If you have no insurance, that health care money gets shifted onto those through premium rate increases. So there is a large expense being paid out on the back end where we could have prevented things, and that's actually being paid for by all the citizens of the United States in terms of increased premiums and increased taxation. A third problem, and I'll mention six quickly, the third problem is we've got the wrong team of physicians on the field, as opposed to, again, having a prevention and wellness-based system where we have enough primary care physicians to allow timely access to care. We've built up an armada on the back end of the healthcare system of a lot of subspecialists. If you will, it's like having a huge fire department. We have developed the best and biggest fire department in the world. We have super fire trucks and firehouses and fire hoses, and we can put out fires at 100 yards. But what we're lacking is an understanding of what's causing these in the first place. We're not addressing the upfront fires, if you will, as opposed to just fighting all these fires downstream. So we have the wrong team on the field. We need more primary care. We need a better balance of our health care system. We're out of balance in terms of the health care team on the field. Another problem is that we have a poor quality system. And many of the listeners out there may say, well, how can that be? Well, what happens in the United States is that those with coverage get timely access and they get to see the physicians they want, and they don't understand that 50 million other people don't. And so we have this divided have and have not system. And how that plays out in terms of quality then, and your listeners may not be aware of this, is that the United States ranks 37th in the world for our healthcare outcomes. That is right behind Costa Rica in terms of where we rank. And it's not because those who can get health care don't get high-quality care. It's because so many people who don't have access in a timely way don't get good health care. So when you average that all together, that's what takes us down to number 37. And I'll just mention two last things. We don't have a focus on our country towards prevention at all. We have a very reactive sick care system. We do not have a proactive wellness or prevention-based system. And lastly, we have major issues with our insurance companies and our insurance coverage. We have a system that's now created the ability to not cover people and to deny them coverage for pre-existing problems, or to resize them from programs if they get sick. So at a time when the people of our country need health insurance the most and they get sick, they can't get it at all. And so that leads to a tremendous problem in terms of medical bankruptcies. In fact, your listeners may not know, but the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States isn't from home mortgage defaults or our finance system or our banking system. It's from medical bills. And that leads to 1.5 million people per year having medical bankruptcies. And I think that's really sad for a country like ours. And then just lastly, one last problem, and I kind of alluded to this, and that's just the cost of our health care system. For the fact and the honor of being 37th in the world, we have the number one most expensive health care system in the world. In fact, it costs us 2 to 4 times more than all the industrialized nations in terms of the cost per capita of health care in our country. So for the privilege of paying the most, we have mediocre to poor outcomes. We have a lot of people that can't get covered. We have problems with timely access. We don't have a focus on prevention. We have a focus on reaction to people's diseases and sicknesses, and not to keep them away from needing all those things in the first place.
These are very important issues, and many we have discussed. There's a couple of issues that we have not focused on as much that I'd like to ask you to talk about more. One of them is how we're paid, how physicians, how people in the healthcare system are paid, and how that relates to cost. And I'm talking about the fee-for-service model that we currently have, and which you've discussed in your book, versus the way most other developed nations in the world are paying for healthcare.
Yeah, that's a great point. The fee-for-system service and system that we have in the United States rewards volume, and it rewards doing things to people, procedures, either in the form of operations or radiologic imaging or lab studies. And so, you know, if you have a healthcare system that'll pay you to do things, then you do things. What happens in other countries that have been able to get around this is that as opposed to concentrating on volume, they concentrate more on value, meaning that it's the outcomes that they're most interested in, not just the volume. And so the payment incentives change in those countries so that the patients, first of all, in many of the countries either don't have bills that they face for using the healthcare system, or they have an insurance system that that covers almost the majority of their costs. They've balanced their primary care system so they have timely access, and then they align the incentives then towards payment, not on volume, but on keeping people healthy. And so the outcomes that they're looking for is health, not disease or not sickness. And so it's all kind of a matter of paying for what you want. Our healthcare system pays for disease. It doesn't pay for health. And that's the key piece here, is that If you take a look at what happens in hospitals and emergency rooms, it's illness and disease. Healthy people aren't going to those places. It's diseased people that are going to those places. And just, you know, as a piece of insight to this, it takes a lot less money to take care of healthy people than it does sick people. And so that's why I say we've just got the wrong focus on our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was reading your book, it seemed to me that was one of the ideas that kind of helped me understand the cost issue, why it's so much more. We're spending so much more in this country compared to everybody else, and we're getting less for our money.
Absolutely right. And, you know, I use in the book a metaphor that I like, especially as we just went through the NBA World Finals here. We have the five best basketball players on the planet. We've got outstanding physicians. We really do. But the way our payment system works is we each give them a basketball, and we tell them to dribble around at random and shoot at will. And our payment system then rewards them for every shot taken. Doesn't matter if you make a basket or not. It's just that you're shooting shots. And so just imagine these five great players. They're all arcing up basketballs as fast as they can. They're just shooting, and most of the time, you know, they're not even hitting the backboard. Their air balls are clanking off the back iron. Occasionally some are going in. And then we play a team like France or England or Spain or New Zealand or Australia or Japan, and we get beat. And the reason we get beat in the United States, despite the fact that we have the five best players on the planet, is that we don't pass the ball. We do not play as a team. We don't integrate and coordinate care. We don't pass information to each other in a timely way. And so the result of this is that we've got a very fragmented, uncoordinated system that doesn't play together. And we've got, despite the best basketball players on the planet, a system that'll pay you to shoot. And so all of a sudden you've got a lot of shooters, no passers, no integration, no coordination.
Hmm. That's a great analogy. Another issue that made me understand better the exorbitant cost that we have relative to everybody else, and I want to say up front, every country is struggling with costs. I understand that. The issue is why we're so out of line with everybody else. And this had to do with health insurance. And you make the comment, and I'm paraphrasing here, that when health insurance got started in the United States, it was community rated in the way premiums were designed, but later moved to experience rated plans. Can you explain that difference? I think that's also important, especially as we begin this debate about the constitutionality of a national health insurance mandate.
Yeah, Thad, I'm glad you brought up this point. What a community rating system for health insurance is, and this is how our country started out, was that everybody's in, no one's out. In other words, you take a look at all the people and you charge them a fair price with no differences for age or medical conditions. It's just part of getting into an insurance plan. And then by pooling everybody into one plan, then the plan covers those that need more care. That was found by for-profit insurance companies to be not the best way to make money. It may have been the best way to provide a clear and equitable and fair system of health insurance, but it was not one that made money. What made money was to parse out the population and to start to charge different premiums then to different people based on their illness or their medical history. So, for instance, if you were older than someone else, you'd be charged more. If you were a woman who could have problems with childbirth, you got charged more. If you were a smoker, or a heavy drinker, you got charged more. If you had diabetes or asthma or some chronic disease, you got charged more. So all of a sudden, we had a system of experiential rating now versus community rating that started to parse out the population for the sole purpose of making money for the insurance companies. It wasn't to provide better health care to the patients. It was to make profit for insurance companies. And what happens in the rest of the world is that they don't have insurance companies that are beholden to stockholders before they're beholden to the patients of the country they're serving. And that's where our system got off track with health insurance. We went from a community-rated system for the good of the whole to an experiential-rated system for the good of the shareholders' profit. And that is part of, again, why our healthcare system is off track in regards to trying to provide good healthcare. Now, there's one other point I want to make about cost, and I think it's important for your listeners to know this and why this is a big deal for the United States, especially at this time, is that the cost of our healthcare system is $2.6 trillion a year, $2.6 trillion a year. That's 17% of the gross domestic product of the United States. In other words, if you sum up all the amount of money spent in the United States per year, 17% of that is going into healthcare costs. That's as of today as we talk on the phone. Now, the problem is that in the year 2025, that amount escalates to becoming 25% of the gross domestic product. That means one out of every $4 is spent on healthcare. And in the year 2082, it becomes 50% of the gross domestic product, meaning one out of every $2 is spent in the on healthcare in the United States. There is no way our country can sustain itself and to provide the growth necessary for all the other things the United States does if half of all of the money spent in our country is going into this black hole of healthcare. And that's why we had to get this under control now. Medicare is projected to become insolvent in 2023. That's only 11 years from now. And at a time where we are growing Medicare by 10,000 new patients a day, we're projected to go from 41 million people that are on Medicare right now as I talk on the phone to you to 82 million in the next 15 years. That's because the baby boomers are growing into Medicare at the rate of 10,000 new patients a day. So all of a sudden, this big cost issue, at the same time that we've got the wrong team on the field, that we're working on the back end of healthcare, i.e. the disease and sickness approach, as opposed to keeping people healthy and keeping them motivated to stay in good health, as opposed to having diseases rack up, all start to really financially threaten our country for its own financial security.
Let me quickly announce our phone number again and remind people that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm talking with Dr. Ted Epperly today, and we're talking about our health care almost non-system, as some people have described it, and our increasing costs and lack of good accountability for where this money is going as far as quality indicators, despite some excellent ability to provide health care. So if you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. Back just briefly to the insurance issue, because I saw a connection between that comment and understanding that now the problem with 21 states deciding, because basically, as I understand it, because of their concern about Medicaid costs growing and the feeling that they must do something about that. So they've sued to repeal the mandate and some other issues regarding the Obama health care plan or the accountable care plan. So it made me think a little bit. There's a connection between this this issue of community rated and experience rated, and for insurance to work well, we have to have everybody involved in the pool to really make insurance work effectively. And so that's what led to this mandated idea of health insurance. Is that correct, or correct me if I'm wrong?
No, that's right, Ted. You know, the individual mandate is to try to get everybody into the pool so that you don't have people that are not covered and then live sicker and then end up going to the emergency room or needing hospitalization, which is a higher cost care for them. In other words, we want people to be covered so that they can have places to go on the front end of the healthcare system. In other words, primary care offices to either family doctors or general internists or general pediatricians, so that they can start to get timely care for problems at an earlier stage, so that they don't grow into larger problems on the back end. And we want to direct them in that direction in our healthcare system and align incentives for them to utilize that system, so that they're not using the wrong doors of the healthcare system, which are right into our emergency rooms or hospitals. That actually is where they should go if they failed to have their healthcare systems or healthcare problems be cared for. It shouldn't be their destination of first access into the healthcare system. So the fact that many people don't have a place to go because they have no coverage, end up then in ERs and hospitals, again, is really a symptom of our disease. And the disease, if you will, looking at the system as a whole, is the inability to get people in a timely way to the front end of our healthcare system, which is to the primary care system. To your earlier statement, 26 states have sued the federal government over the issue of the individual mandate, in the sense of, is it constitutional to require people to have health insurance? And I just want to make a point to the listeners out there that if you get outside the United States, every single healthcare system in the industrialized world has an individual mandate. It is only in the United States that we're really struggling with the fact that should we have everybody be included in this larger pool so that we can help move towards a system for the good of all versus, again, the benefits of a few. In other words, if you've got health insurance, then you feel like, okay, well, I've got mine, now you get yours. The problem is that 50 million people have decided, either because they couldn't afford it or because they just were going to freeload on the system and pass the cost on to others, that they weren't going to get it. So that was point one of the major issue of around the constitutionality. The second major issue, and I just want to point this out to the readers too, and you alluded to the listeners, and you alluded to it, Thad, is that the Medicaid expansion piece is another large piece of the Affordable Care Act. In other words, part of the coverage of these 50 million people were to include the size of the Medicaid population being covered. So half of the population of Alaska, just like it is in Idaho, that are now going to find themselves being able to potentially have insurance is through the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program in all states is a shared state and federal program. So, for instance, in Idaho, where I live in Boise, 30 cents for every dollar is put in by the state of Idaho, 70 cents is put in by the federal government. So many of the states, 26 of them, found that that was unconstitutional to require that this expansion then came at state cost. In other words, a certain percent would go towards that. And so part of the Supreme Court hearing that will be released, as I best understand it, on Thursday of this week, is to take a look at that individual mandate. Is it constitutional or not that everybody must have health insurance? And the second thing is around the constitutionality of should states be drug into then paying more to help their patients that are uninsured in the state be covered.
Okay. We have a caller, Dr. Epperle. I want to take her call. Sylvia, you're on line one.
Yes, first of all, I wanted to say I'd like to jump up and down when I heard Dr. Epperle bring up the for-profit insurance companies, and I feel like that is so wrong and so crazy to have these insurance companies making money off the backs of sick people. I mean, they pay their the insurance CEOs many of multi-million dollar salaries, and it's just ludicrous that we would allow that to happen. So I wanted to thank you for bringing that up. I think it's a very important part that's not emphasized enough when healthcare comes up. Also, so many of the doctors now are pushed to see more and more patients in shorter time periods, and they're rewarded for this. And I think it's very important to be able to have the time to listen to your patient's stories, and it makes a huge difference in the outcome if there's more time and if that's rewarded rather than just how many patients can you see in an hour. So there's a book, another book actually called The Lost Art of Healing, that's a very interesting book by Bernard Lowen, L-O-W-N, that addresses some of that. But again, thank you so much for bringing up the for-profit healthcare industry and how that's really detrimental to our society. We wouldn't make money off of firefighters putting off fires or policemen doing their jobs. They don't have shareholders waiting for a dividend from that. So I hope, thank you for bringing up again. So that's right. What my comment. Yeah,
thanks for your comment, Sylvia. Dr. Epperle, you have any retort?
Yeah. First, thank you, Sylvia, as well. And, I agree. I've been a family doctor for 32 years, and I'm frustrated with the insurance companies. I think many people are. I mean, I'm a patient as well, and I can't believe some of the stuff that I see, not only as a physician, but as a patient, when I need to utilize the system around the insurance companies. I can make heads nor tails of the bill I get from them, and I'm constantly struggling to understand why it is that they're excluding a certain amount of payment. I mean, they've been happy to take my money and my family's money for quite a few years, and then I struggled to get them to do what I thought they were supposed to do, which is to help pay for healthcare costs. And so that's point one. The second point that Sylvia made was physicians being kind of pushed to see more volume, and I couldn't agree more. And for any of us that are primary care physicians, and in your audience, Dad, I'm sure there are primary care physicians that are hearing this or will hear this as well. We feel like we're hamsters on a treadmill. We're running as fast as we can in a volume-based system, because it is a fee-for-service system at this point in time, to see people to make overhead. And we've got to get off the treadmill. This is ludicrous. The whole idea should be not to see patients, just to see patients to make money. The whole purpose should be to keep people actually from needing to even come into the office by being healthy. So if we want to align a system to keep people healthy and in their homes and in their jobs and functional, because nobody wants to be in an office or an ER or a hospital, I don't. I don't want to go waste 4 hours sitting around in a doctor's office or 8 hours in an ER or 2 days or 3 days in a hospital. I want to have all that prevented. So if we're going to get to that, then what we need to do is align what we're paying for better. And the payment should be not for fee-for-service. It shouldn't be for volume. It should be for taking my 2,000 patients and keeping them healthy so that I get a certain amount of payment per patient per month to coordinate their care, to integrate it, to work proactively with patient education, to send out emails and to have them have sites where they can read up on conditions, and I can proactively engage with them through my staff and myself to keep them healthy. And only those that need my care need to come into the office. And let's say that I can take care of these 2,000 patients in a way in which I start to reduce my volumes in the office because of proactive outreach. My nurses, my medical assistants are working with them, and so that I only need to see 8 to 10 patients a day versus 20 to 30 patients a day, then I can spend more time with them. I can give them the treatment and the time that's necessary and listen to the stories and listen to what it is that truly needs to be done for them. So it's all a matter of incentives, and that's why I say that really what we're going to get in our healthcare system is what we pay for. The one truth that I've really found out in 32 years of being a doctor is if you want to figure out anything about the United States healthcare system, all you need to focus on is how the money works, where the money goes. And where it goes is what gets done in our healthcare system. So if you want to get it different, then you realign what you pay for.
Let's take our typical break. We've been moving very fast here, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about suggestions for reform. Remind our listeners, once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, then we'll continue to take calls and emails as we talk with Dr. Ted Epperle. This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Ted Epperle. He is discussing with us his analysis of the problems of our healthcare system, and we're about to talk about some suggestions for change. This is all very well laid out in his book, Fractured, America's Broken Healthcare System, and What We Must Do to Heal It. You can email questions over the next 30 minutes or so to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us directly at 550-8433, and you can reach us by a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 o'clock Anchorage time in Anchorage, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we won't be able to take phone calls or emails at that time. Dr. Epperle, you know, when Sylvia made her comment about the profits of healthcare, of the health insurance industry, I immediately had a pang of guilt because one of the problems, as you've addressed and what we've talked about when you think about it, is all of us in the healthcare system, physicians, hospitals, laboratories, are all making profits on people being sick. And that maybe is another way to look at why we spend so much money. And as you've put it in a nutshell, we've got to change those incentives towards health and change how we're really providing health care in this country, much more in a line with what other countries are doing. But perhaps we have other ideas as well, which we'll get into. Is that also fair to say?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, and I just make a couple quick comments to that, and I do address this in the book, too, that really we don't have a healthcare system, we have a wealth care system, and what I mean by that is our healthcare system has generated a lot of money for a lot of people, and what I found when I got engaged with these issues, and as the president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. During the healthcare reform debates and spoke with Congress and President Obama on multiple occasions around this. And what I came to find is that there are a lot of people that absolutely don't want to see our healthcare system change. And the reason for that is because they don't want to have a change in the revenue generation structure of this. I mean, when you're dealing with the largest economic sector in the entire American economy, which is healthcare, weighing in at $2.6 trillion a year, there are a lot of reasons to fight to keep it just as it is. And that's led me, sadly, to say the following, and that is that healthcare has sadly become more of a business than a profession. People have become way too concerned about what it means to their personal incomes as opposed to what it means to the health of the people we're here to serve.
Yeah, this is a big issue, and I wish we had more time. I can already tell that I'd like to spend a lot more time on it, and we do have several phone calls, but I would like everybody to hang on. I want you to go over what you're describing as your six pillars of healthcare reform, and I want us also speak to what you're going to mention is the patient-centered medical home is part of the answer to this before we open up and try to answer some of our phone calls and emails. So if you don't mind, the six pillars of reform.
You bet, Thad. Thank you. You know, what I'd like to say to folks is that first we need to start with the basics. Our basics are that we want an accessible system of care that provides high quality and lower cost. I think we can all agree with that, and I think everybody in the American healthcare system can agree with that. The second thing that I think we've really got to get our heads wrapped around is that healthcare should be a basic human right. I equate two things in our country is that everybody should be afforded. One is a basic education, K through 12. I just think that we all are a better society if we can provide that to people. And along with that is the basic right to basic health care. And that doesn't mean all of the bells and whistles. That means basic primary care, basic prevention, basic immunizations, so that people can get into a system where those basic health care needs can be cared for. And then, of course, if issues come from that in terms of disease and sickness, well, we're prepared then to deal with that. The third thing that I'd say is we must restore primary care to being a robust system in the United States. When you get outside the U.S. and you take a look at the balance of the workforce, I alluded to this earlier, that balance is about 50-50, 50% of the physicians being in primary care, 50% in the subspecialty cares. It's like having a balanced symphony. We're out of balance. In the United States right now, as I talk with you, we have 70% that are in subspecialties and 30% in primary care. We're really out of balance. But here's the frightening thing. If you take a look at the last 15 years of graduates from the United States medical schools, 90% are going into subspecialties and 10% are going into primary care. They're following the money. And that has led to this very out-of-balance symphony, if you will. It's like having too many tubas and too many French horns and not enough strings. And so we have a distorted symphony that's playing. Two other quick points. Thad, you'd alluded to the patient-centered medical home. What this is for the listeners is a model of care that starts to coordinate and integrate care at the primary care level in the community, so that as opposed to, again, having this reactive healthcare system that you just go to when you're sick, it starts to coordinate through trusted relationships with a primary care physician that you get to see and know over time, so that the system can start to focus on keeping you healthy and away from all those other things that you may not need at all. And in fact, you know, by having that trusted relationship, I can deal proactively with my patients in terms of what they need and maybe even more importantly, what they don't need. Because I can tell you, if you get too much health care and you get too much stuff being done by the health care system, it can be dangerous to you as well. There are all sorts of complications and side effects. There are all sorts of things that are unnecessary and problems that can lead to other problems. So you need somebody that can advocate for you in a way to keep you at the center of the system and not to have the system be the center of the system. And then lastly, and I want to make this point because I think it's really valuable, and that is that more than doctors and more than hospitals and more than insurance companies in terms of making healthcare decisions in our country, by far more decisions are made by the women of our communities, mothers to families, older daughters to sick and aging parents, spouses to recalcitrant husbands. I cannot tell you how important the women of our country are in terms of being a solution to our health care woes. And we as a country and a society should value everything they do in terms of making good decisions at home and in the community, and we should empower them in regards to having our system work proactively with them through better education, better tools online to make choices, help make choices for families to align with their primary care physicians and other community resources to keep their families healthy.
I'm going to read now an email that from someone who anticipated that you were going to get into the patient-centered medical home. This comes from a nurse. She says, first, a comment regarding the patient-centered medical home. I believe this is a very powerful model for healthcare, and I'm so glad to work in a practice that is working toward this system. I see the impact on to our families daily and feel fulfilled as a nurse, being able to provide care that is patient-centered and not cost-directed. I have two questions. One, in the event that the Supreme Court rules against the Affordable Care Act, how do you recommend small practices continue on the path of improved care when incentives such as meaningful use in patient-centered medical home are removed? This may not be a barrier for all, but it certainly will be for some. So she's worried about what do we do if the Supreme Court rules against it. And two, for those of us who are committed to improving healthcare experience for patients, what do you recommend is the most important thoughts to keep in mind?
Okay. Good question. Let me start with the latter question first. The most important thing to keep in mind, I think, is that the reason that we all went into medicine and why the healthcare system exists is to serve people. So if we keep people at the center of our compass so that we're doing the right things at the right time for the right reasons to people, we'll start as a country to make better healthcare decisions in terms of why we're doing what we're doing. So the most important thing is to keep the patient at the center of the system. We have a system that keeps doctors and hospitals and health insurances at the center of the system, and that needs to change. That's why I use the term fractured in our book. We've got a broken healthcare system with the wrong focus and the wrong people in the center of the system. In terms of if the American or the Affordable Care Act goes down in terms of the Supreme Court ruling, what I would say is in regards to the writer had mentioned meaningful use for electronic medical records. Fortunately, that's not covered by the Affordable Care Act. That was in the legislation that preceded that. It was called the ERA stimulus bill. So the electronic medical records are still going to be covered independent of what happens with the Affordable Care Act. So I just wanted that particular listener to know that. But as far as the patient-centered medical home goes, in terms of if the Affordable Care Act is struck down, that concept will not go away. The genie is out of the bottle in regards to the evolution of our healthcare system to a better, more timely, accessible system for people. So regardless of all of this, whatever happens with the Affordable Care Act, we must as a nation find a better healthcare system. And so if it goes down, which would be sad to me because there are many, many, many good things in the Affordable Care Act that helps our system get better, I can most assuredly tell the listeners that they will absolutely, as Congress and as our nation, must get back to work. They have to come up with another bill that makes more common sense to people to get the job done, because we can't afford not to do this. We absolutely are getting sucked down the black hole of cost until we get this under control. So to that person, and I'll end with this, is keep the faith here. We're on the track of starting to do the right things for the right reasons to people, and that's not going to go away. I think America is fed up, quite frankly, with our healthcare system, not again because we don't have good people in it who care. It's that the system sucks. And I just need to reemphasize it. This is a systems issue. Our system is broken. Our system is fractured.
Okay. Tiffany, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I have a question, a kind of a broad question, but regarding being motivated by the earnings of a profession, how would the solutions that you're proposing help alleviate medical school costs so that when people enter their profession, they can have something in mind, maybe their passion, above just the debt that they need to repay? Is there a way to fix that system in tandem with what you're proposing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tiffany. And for the listeners out there, what the average medical student coming out of the American medical school system, because remember that's 4 years of college and 4 years of medical school, so it's 8 years of professional training. The average person in the U.S. is coming out with $150,000 in medical school and college loans. That's what the average is. I've seen residents here in my program have over $300,000 in those loans, and as you can imagine, that's like coming out already out of school with a mortgage on a house. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so to try to get at that, first, I just think the cost of both college education and medical school education has gone through the stratosphere. I mean, it is almost unaffordable to people. That has to be fixed unto itself. But in regard to the question now on hand, which is if you come out with $150,000, then it tends to have young physicians make the wrong selections. They end up then going after the money in terms of what they can make, even though they may love to have been a primary care physician, which, by the way, is on the lowest end of the pay scale in medicine, and go after the higher dollars as being a subspecialist or a subspecialty surgeon. And that's creating, again, the wrong workforce. We don't need a million dermatologists and anesthesiologists or orthopedic surgeons. We need a whole lot more primary care physicians to fix this problem. So one thing that's in the Affordable Care Act that starts to fix all of this were scholarships then and loan repayment to be targeted towards primary care physicians to help offset the cost of that education so that they weren't making decisions to become super subspecialized physicians for financial reasons and were doing it more for conscious reasons. And so that is the one big piece that's looked at in there to try to write this was to then provide more scholarships on the front end of medical school and more loan repayment on the back end of medical school to help offset those medical school loans.
Okay.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you very
You're
much.
Welcome.
Yep. We have lots of phone calls and emails. We're not going to get to all of them, but I'll ask people to hold on. I'll do my best. But one issue that I would also like you to address perhaps briefly, but I thought was one of the more enlightening and educational parts of your book, and that's why Americans, what our ethics, what our morality, what our culture says that makes us struggle with this health care reform and why we're having so much trouble getting there.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I'm sensitive to the time too. So I'll try to keep this short. This is a full chapter, and I go into a 9 reasons why the United States struggles. I'll give you just a couple of them. It really gets back to our basic nature as Americans. We were formed as a country that was breaking away from a lot of the world powers. We had people, pioneers and the like, and our founding fathers that were very individual, rugged individualists. We wanted to be independent. Autonomy and our freedom of choice were very dear values to us as a nation. And what that leads to when it then comes to something like health care is if you have an attitude towards health care as being an individual, just an individual attitude about, well, I've got mine, now you get yours, and we're kind of rugged individualists in this, it makes it very hard for our country to pull together as a nation for the good of everyone, for the good of the whole. We look more askance at people that are having health care problems or are obese or have smoking problems, or you name it, fill in the blank. And we don't pull together well as a country around this. We value more the fact that as individuals, this is something that is a basic right to us as individuals to either have health or not have health, and we don't see this as something to norm to. What the other countries in the world do better than us is that they've seen that basic health care is an individual right. It should be something that the country affords to their people for the good of the country as a whole. And so it leads me to conclude on this that America as a country is pretty young and immature. The issues of independence and autonomy and choice are issues of adolescence and young adulthood. Issues of stability and making sure everybody is cared for are concepts of an older, more mature country. We are 230-some years old. The European nations are thousands of years old. They've gone through war, they've gone through famine, they've gone through pestilence, and they've recognized that the greater good is serving and making sure that everybody has some sort of health care for their country's good. Our country is immature in this aspect. We act like adolescents. And so healthcare reform becomes a reflection, really, of who we are as a people. And as a country, we're adolescent compared to the rest of the world.
Thank you. I think that chapter we all should read just for some insight on what we are and what we need to prioritize. Here's an email. What percent of the whole total cost of healthcare goes into insurance administration costs as compared to actual medical costs? What are we paying in administrative costs?
Yeah, that's a very good question. On average, that's about 20 cents on the dollar. 20% goes into the admin. Now, here's an incredible fact about this. If you look at the Medicare system in our country, only 3 cents on the dollar goes into administrative cost. In Medicaid, it's only 5 cents on the dollar. But in our private insurance companies, it's at average 20 cents on the dollar. When you get outside the U.S. again and you take a look at these other countries, they're paying 1 to 2 cents on the dollar, 1 to 2%. Going into admin. That means that 98% are going into healthcare costs. In Medicare, 97 cents on the dollar going into healthcare costs. Medicaid, 95 cents on the dollar. In private insurance companies, 80 cents on the dollar on average. And so, again, a lot of the overhead cost is being stripped away, both into administrative costs, but also into stockholder profit and CEO salaries. That's a problem.
I want to just focus on one little bit of information I also got. There's a lot of big numbers that get thrown around. Our cost of healthcare are going up about $100 billion a year. And Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel has written some comments in the New York Times, and he points out that all the profits of all the insurance companies per year is only 0.5% of all of that $100 billion. So we have to address more than just that issue. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
We say about Medicare I'm on, but we that use Medicare get blamed for using it, and I heard your speaker say a system sucks. That is right. It sucks money out of everybody. But anyway, I heard a little bit of blame the victim, especially women. They can only get educated from a doctor. But anyway, I got about three comments here. And it seems like we always are attacking the symptoms and not the cause. And it isn't the cost of Medicare. It's the pricing of Medicare by the Medicare industry. And they can get away with that, whatever paid. And I've been through misdiagnosis at an emergency room and a bunch of bad deals, too. And you take a look around. TV advertisement, medical. They've pretty much paid them on. They don't want to lose advertising. Print media, Newsweek, et cetera, look at all the pages. They don't want to lose advertising by saying anything about it. And then, of course, we have the legislators. They get donations. So it seems to me we're just talking about, your speaker tells us a whole bunch of things that we already know, but what can we actually do about it that's concrete until somebody gets a handle on the industry itself, who could, it's like the oil industry. They can price whatever they want and get away with it. And in the Germany and other countries I've followed, there's cost fixing by the government, and this is what you get. Now, when are we going to, why haven't
let's let Dr.
medical industry?
Yeah, let's let Dr. Epperle respond, because we're getting down the last couple of minutes. Dr. Epperle?
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you bet. No, very good questions. I did want to clarify one thing in case other listeners were confused. I wasn't at all blaming or victimizing women. I think women are part of the solution. I'm very impressed that actually they're much more level-headed than most of us, and they're part of the the solution, and they just need to be worked with better. And that was my point about women. They're part of the solution, not part of the problem. In terms of your bigger point about Medicare pricing, you're exactly right. Where we really got off in terms of overvaluing, if you will, procedures was through Medicare. And so part of the Affordable Care Act and part of what starts to get at the symptoms here and the roots of the problems instead of just the symptoms is by realigning payment through Medicare. And so part of the Affordable Care Act is looking at absolutely doing that. It's paying more for primary care and starting to decrease the costs of unnecessary care, both in terms of hospitalizations and rehospitalizations, as well as procedural costs that have gone through the roof. So you're dead on right that Medicare becomes the beating heart of health care reform in terms of repricing at the Medicare level. And repricing at the Medicare level starts to act as the American health insurance companies key their pricing costs off of the Medicare costs. So if you start to reprice Medicare costs, then the other insurance companies start to reprice and the whole cost of the system starts to get realigned.
Okay. You know, we're entering kind of the last couple of minutes, Dr. Epperle, and I really like guests to have an opportunity to really leave us with a couple of thoughts that they really want us to remember. It's so difficult to hear all this. I'll definitely recommend your book and talk about it again. But what do you want us to remember?
First, thank you for the opportunity to speak to your audience. What I would leave the audience with is that let's all keep the faith here in the sense of we're all in this together as human beings on this planet. We should be looking after each other better in the sense of trying to create a healthcare system that ensures that not only you and your family, but our neighbors and other people are getting good health care. Our country can do that. It's within us as people to do that, and quite frankly, we can do that in a more efficient and cost-effective manner. About a third of that $2.6 trillion that I'm talking about is waste in our system. It's inefficiency, it's redundancy, it's stuff that doesn't need to be done. We have more than enough resources to be able to provide this type of care, quality care to people, in a way that does not increase our taxation through the roof. And so I think what I would leave with you is we need a better focus on health care versus disease care. We need to concentrate on increasing the number of primary care providers so that we have timely access for people in a patient-centered way that focuses on their issues, right types of care at the right places at the right time. We need to make sure that we all focus on getting health insurance to serve the people and not to bleed the people. So those would be the big points, I think, that I'd leave your listeners with.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, one of the big issues that I keep coming back to or hearing is that the whole system, we need to make a system, which we don't have. We got so many different ways we're doing it, but also a focus on changing the incentives on what we're doing in healthcare for all of us involved. Is that also a part of what you're saying?
Oh, I sure am, and I'm glad you made that point. You know, it's all about aligning incentives, and if we start to align towards health versus disease, and we pay for that, and in fact, you know, we didn't get into this much, but individual responsibility of the patients. Why should we not have premium reductions or incentives go back to patients for good health behavior? I think we should. You know, we all do better if we're incentivized, and I think patients are a big part of this as well, and we should honor that and incentivize them as well.
Thanks again for your time. It's been wonderful. I wish you the best. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Thad. It's my pleasure, too. And I wish everybody in Alaska and your listening audience the best of health.
Thank you again. I would highly recommend Dr. Epperle's book, Fractured, America's Broken Healthcare System and What We Must Do to Heal It. If you want to continue today's conversation, you can join KSK on Facebook. You find the link at alaskapublic.org. Through the varies of scheduling, we're going to have another program on healthcare next week when Dr. Margaret Flowers of the organization Physicians for a National Healthcare Program will be our guest. She believes that what we need is a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health insurance plan. So why not learn more and join us on Line 1 next Monday, July 2nd from 2 to 3 p.m. Pat Yeck is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Emily Saul helped with the phone calls today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.